The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got a whole slew of Qs, the questions you've sent in. We're going to try our best to give you reliable answers to those questions. I'll try not to be too distracted. I'm texting back and forth as we're recording this. My wife battling a flat tire on her car, but she seems to have it well in hand, so hopefully I won't be ridiculed too much when I get home. When I didn't go help her and instead recorded a podcast with Jim. So,
would you like to pause before?
No. Looks like she's at the tire shop with it. So it wasn't completely flat like a blowout. It was just some,
it's had
a slow leak in it and apparently it became faster today. So I think we're good to go.
So it's not like she's abandoned on the side of I-25 battling rush hour traffic.
She's in the competent hands of our favorite tire place. So,
which is?
You want me to give it a shout out on the podcast?
I don't know. I usually go to the Husqvarna's.
Oh, yeah. No, by our house, we have a discount tire. That particular one, I'm not necessarily endorsing all of them, but I usually have pretty good luck at the one near our house in South Fort Collins. So she's there, and I know they're competent enough to take care of a flat tire, so I have no doubt that she'll be well taken care of, and when I get home, we'll have a full and fully sealed air-retaining tire, like as it should be.
So you won't have a pissed-off wife, is what you're saying?
Well, we'll see how long she has to wait. Because this was a no appointment-style drop-in, so sometimes it can be kind of busy. It sounds okay. The texts haven't gotten too aggressive yet, so I think we're good to go.
All righty. Well, let's jump in, folks. This is the Q&A show. My name is Jim, as you probably know, and that was Chris, who is married to, oh, goodness, Melissa, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Excellent. I got the name right.
Very nice.
A very lovely lady who apparently has a flat tire.
Yeah.
But she's in good hands. So we're going to get into the Q&A show. You send in the Qs and we provide the A's. And as we always do, we're going to lead with one or two Social Security questions. We are in the January list of questions, but this Social Security question, I think we're hitting February now with Social Security questions, but still January-ish with regular email questions. This one came in on February 6th, does not give their name nor their state of residence. But it was an interesting question. One thing that I did with this question that I very rarely do, I sent it to Chris ahead of time so he could listen to another person's podcast and then provide his answer to this person. And that's what you did, correct? Mm-hmm.
I did. They claimed something was shared in another podcast, and it seemed to conflict with something that I said. And he was writing in for clarification, and I wanted to verify that what the other podcaster said was actually what they said.
Okay. So perfect. So let's get to it. So it begins, hello. I have a Social Security question. On your show, you have said when a spouse claims their own benefit at age 62, they will receive a decreased spousal benefit, assuming half of the spouse is higher than all of their own at their full retirement age. But I was listening to Mary Beth Franklin, and she is a pretty well-known Social Security expert. And on her podcast, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Social Security, towards the back third of it, she stated that a spouse could claim their own benefit at 62 and then take their spousal benefit at 67 and receive 100% of those benefits. I could easily be missing something, or you're all correct and just stating it differently, but I was looking for some clarity. And then he or she ends it with thanks, but no name, so we'll call them George or Georgette, and no state, so we're going to assume they're from the good state of Kentucky.
Of all the states to assume, that's where we're assuming?
Well, you know, that's where I might move to, so this might be a fellow Kentuckian.
Maybe.
All right.
So let me first state that Mary Beth Franklin is indeed a well-known expert on Social Security. She has her own podcast. It's quite a bit younger than ours, hasn't been around for very long. She hasn't been in the podcast world as long as we have. However, she's a well-known author and speaker at conferences and the like on the subject of Social Security. And I learned a lot of what I know directly from reading those writings from Mary Beth Franklin. So I have utmost respect for Mary Beth Franklin. This particular episode, entitled, as they said, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Social Security, is, if somebody wants to go listen to it, Season 4, Episode 8 of her podcast, I believe, is called The Retirement Repair Shop. And it is true that in the last third of that podcast, she's describing a situation where a spouse is claiming early and then getting a different benefit later. But the disconnect here is that she was talking about survivor benefits later, not spousal benefits later. It is, in fact, true that if you claim your own benefit at 62, which if you've been a listener for any time whatsoever or looked into Social Security, you realize that will decrease your benefit compared to what you would get at your full retirement age. That decrease will be somewhere between 25 and 30%, depending on what your full retirement age is. That will be a reduction to your own benefit. Later on, if you are claiming a survivor benefit because your spouse passed away, the fact that you claimed early at 62 will not reduce the survivor benefit, assuming you've made it to your full retirement age before they passed away and you were claiming the survivor benefit. It is actually possible for you to make a second decision to claim the survivor benefit early, and that would be reduced. But the act of claiming your own does not transfer over and reduce the survivor benefit. That's the distinction. That's what Mary Beth Franklin was talking about at that point in the podcast. What this listener who wrote to us is confusing is spousal benefits are different. A spousal benefit is when your spouse is alive. A survivor benefit is when your spouse has passed away. It is true that what I claimed repeatedly, and Mary Beth Franklin will tell you the same thing, that if you claimed your benefit at 62 and later on turn on a spousal benefit, even if that spousal benefit is after you've turned your full retirement age, the total benefit you're receiving will be permanently reduced because of your earlier decision to claim your own at 62. The reason for that is when you have your own benefit, but you also qualify for a spousal benefit, you're assumed the system pays you your own first and then increases your benefit for the spousal offset, they call it. And the only way to get the full spousal that you might otherwise be entitled to, which is 50% of your spouse's full retirement age benefit, you have to have claimed that whole situation at or after your own full retirement age. So I've talked about this in greater detail. I'm probably not going to go much deeper than this, just to state that the confusion here is common. This is, whenever I talk about these things, I just kind of naturally compare the two because this is so frequently confused. There's rules that are different for spousal versus survivor, and people connect them. They both start with S, and they're both related to your spouse. Having a spouse, the survivor benefit came from your spouse's record. The difference is, in one, they're alive, and the other one, they're dead. So that's the apparent conflict, but there's not a conflict because what she was saying is true, what I'm claiming is true. We're talking about two different things, spousal versus survivor. So hopefully that, I would have no hesitation encouraging people that are looking for Social Security advice to listen to Mary Beth Franklin or read anything that she's written. She's proven to me to be very reliable, very knowledgeable, and I don't recall a time where she has published or said anything that turned out not to be true about Social Security, although it's certainly possible because I haven't read and listened to every single word she's ever said. And she's human, just like I am. I'm sure at certain times I've said something that turned out to be wrong, and vice versa. Let me know if I ever do that. Because that's great that he wrote this. If I was wrong in this, I would want this email to have come into us so I could correct it on the show, because the whole goal here is to provide people with reliable and accurate information.
All righty. And anybody who is looking to correct us on this show, you absolutely can. But please remember how to spell Chris's name. It's not J-I-M. It's C-H-R-I-S. Mm-hmm. So when there's a mistake, make sure you say C-H-R-I-S said something that's not right and didn't pick up on this. You'll be surprised at how many people spell your name wrong.
I have been surprised at that over
the years. It's amazing. It amazes me. They're smart enough to pick up when you say something that's not right, but they can't spell your name. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Okay, the next Social Security question is going to be a little with a twist. You hold in your hands.
In my hands?
In your hands, or in your head. You're going to make one person very happy, and you're going to make one person very upset.
Uh-oh. Oh, because the spouses have a bet on which who's right? Oh.
No.
We've had those before.
I'm just being silly on this one. We received this week, and I just thought we would jump these Social Security questions up because it's my show. We can do that. But one came from a CFP. One came from a CPA. Mm. Who do you want to help this week?
Oh, the that's CPA, how I'm going to make one happy.
Yes, you're going to have one either happy CFP or CPA and one pissed off CFP or CPA. Because we're not going to answer them both this week.
I like things in alphabetical order, so let's do the CFP. They both begin with C, so we go to the second letter, and F comes before P, so CFP it is.
Okay. Sorry, CPA. He's going to be upset. Don't let him do your taxes.
We'll get to it.
We'll get to it next week. Okay, this comes in, I don't know where he's from. Oh, now I do. California.
Okay.
Okay, hi Chris and Jim. I have a Social Security earnings test question. You might want to sharpen your pencil.
I was going to say, am I
going to
need numbers?
Yes. You might want to get your pencil and calculator out. I am 63 years old. I had earnings of $165,000 from January to June of this year. Mm-hmm. I retired July 1st.
Okay.
I wanted to take survivor Social Security benefits starting in July. Mm-hmm. How will the earnings test be applied? I know there is a grace year. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can explain that. However, before you do, I don't know if he added this after or he just wanted to have you think about more. He says, the other part of this is, I was told by Social Security that if I made more than the monthly amount, they will look back and recapture all of the earnings I had for the year and use them to calculate my earnings test. I explained to them that I would remain on payroll making $2,500 a month for the rest of this year, July to December. They said that when that income went into the system, it will fully wipe out my benefit. But I thought the earnings test and my grace period would only look at my July through December earnings, and the fact that I made more than the monthly amount prior to that would only slightly offset my monthly benefit. They said that even after applying the grace year rules, my benefit is still going to be brought down to zero. They said I am $70,000 over the maximum amount of earnings I can have. That confused me when he wrote that, because I thought the grace year doesn't look at the $165,000 he made. And the $2,500 I thought wasn't enough to wipe out everything. So I'm confused. And so is he. And we're both CFPs.
Yeah. So we haven't talked about the grace year for a while. And he's, his second part of the question, he's talking about a nuance to the grace year situation. So let me attack it, the simplest part first. What we're talking about with a grace year, because some people, especially if they're recent, you know, listeners to the show, may not have heard us talk about grace year, because I don't know that we've talked about the grace year when, recently. It's been quite a while. So what the grace year entails is the first year that you're entitled to benefits, they will give you grace, effectively, for the fact that you retired partway through the year, and this, what happened to this person has happened to possibly affect their Social Security benefits. So let me back up a little bit, set the stage, earnings test. Earnings test, if you claim benefits in a year that you are having earnings and you are under your full retirement age. So keep in mind, when you hit your full retirement age, earnings test goes away completely. You can make $1 billion and it doesn't trigger the earnings test. Age 63, which he is, he's definitely under his full retirement age. So he is subject to the earnings test possibly. The earnings test for 2022, and this number changes every year, goes up with inflation, is $19,560. And the general rule is for every dollar that you earn over that threshold, the $19,560. Well, let me say it a different way. For every $2 over that you earn, they're going to reduce your Social Security benefit by a dollar. So he, if we look at it at face value, earning $165,000 already from January to June, he's way beyond that. He's way beyond the $19,560. His Social Security benefit couldn't possibly be large enough to survive that $1 for every $2 offset or adjustment that they're going to make, and he'd be wiped out. But the system's designed so that if you retire partway through the year, instead of them applying the earnings test on an annualized basis, they will instead, in your grace year, apply it on a monthly basis to accommodate this exact thing. What if he truly retired, and let's assume at first he would have no further earnings? They would take that $19,560, divide it by 12, turning it into a monthly limit, and as long as he didn't surpass the $1,630 monthly limit, which is $19,560 divided by 12, they would give him grace and say, even though you earned $165,000, we understand now you are fully retired, you're not earning anymore, so we're not going to apply the earnings test to you as long as you don't violate that $1,630 monthly amount. That's the clean situation where there's no additional nuance to this. And that's the grace. And if you truly have 100% retired, you're not earning anymore, I think you are good to go, essentially. You escape the earnings test in that clean example. Let's now add in the quote nuance that he threw in here in the second half of his description here. He's talking about the fact that he's planning to make $2,500 a month, much lower than his pay rate before, because he made $165,000 in the first 6 months of the year. Now he's still on, quote, payroll for another $2,500 a month. Well, $2,500 is higher than the $1,630, but it's not a ton higher. It's only, you know, $870 a month over. So you might think, oh, well, this is going to take that $870, divide it by two, that dollar for every $2 concept, and there'll be a small earnings test adjustment, etc. My understanding is what they told him. And I'm saying my understanding because I haven't looked at this nuance for quite a while. And if I discover, I'll look at it after the show's over, because Jim kind of sprung this on me, to make absolutely sure that we've got this described properly. I'll follow up next week if I'm not doing this. But I feel pretty comfortable because it's actually what they're telling him, which is you're safe as long as you don't go past that 1630. By default, the earnings test is an annual thing. This is an exception. They're saying, we'll make a special exception for you, and we're calling it the grace year because we're giving you grace by not applying it on an annualized basis because you're only working halfway through the year. We'll then give you this monthly test instead. But if you penetrate past that, the way they walk through the equation and the rules, they then look at your taxable year earnings. So suddenly it opens the door to looking at the annual amount again, and then that's going to blow his benefit out of the water. So I think one of two things either needs to happen. He could, if he really wants the Social Security benefit, negotiate a way with his employer to only pay him $1,600 a month instead of $2,500 a month, so that he doesn't trigger that earnings test look back, essentially, we might call it. It's not really looking back. It's just zooming out to look at the whole year again instead of giving him this grace by looking at it on a month-by-month basis. So, I think he's got trouble if he's going to be making $2,500 a month for the rest of the year. He will then, if he has no other way to manipulate that or adjust that to keep him under that $1,630 monthly testing amount, then he's going to have to wait effectively until January 1st and claim the survivor benefit. And at that point, he didn't say whether he would continue that $2,500. Even then, it wouldn't matter because he wouldn't be looking to use the monthly test at that point. The $2,500 per month, if that were to continue into next year, that's only going to be about $30,000 a year, which, assuming the earnings test doesn't go up, which is going to go up because inflation is so high. So let's say it's going to go up to at least 20,000 is my guess. My guess is probably higher than that. So we'll have $10,000 over. They'll divide that by two. $5,000 would be the earnings test offset to his survivor benefits for the year of 2023. He didn't say that. I'm just kind of extending this as if he continued on making this small amount consulting or whatever he's doing here. If that ends completely, then he doesn't have to worry about the earnings test anymore, and he can collect the full survivor benefit until he later turns on his own. My guess is that's what he's planning to do. Usually people in their earlier 60s, if they're claiming a survivor benefit, are doing that to let their own grow until 70. But that's just a guess on my part. But I do think what they told him is going to undermine his plan of claiming the survivor benefit right now here in July of 2022. But I'll follow up next week if that is incorrect. If there's some other little adjustment to this, I'll let you know. But in this case, kudos to the Social Security rep because I think they got it right in this case.
Let me
point it out. But go ahead.
Let me... Mm-hmm. Ask some questions here because sure. My mind is turning a little. Mm-hmm. He admitted to making 160. I don't have his email in front of me anymore. 165,000. Mm-hmm. His employer is going to be giving him essentially another 15 grand over the last 6 months of the year. Mm-hmm. So what if his employer had paid him $180,000 before he retired July?
Right.
None of this would matter.
That's the kind of manipulation I was talking about. If he could negotiate some adjustment to the way this is being paid, he could solve the problem.
So could he get, say, 15 grand in the month of July, mm-hmm. kind of rule July off, and then beginning August through December, start collecting Social Security?
Yep. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Mm-hmm. There's your answer, listener.
Yeah, so it's possible if he could negotiate such a thing. Now, they'd essentially be forwarding him. They'd be advancing him those last month's worth of pay. Who knows what the relationship is here, if that would work or not, but that would be... that might be a solution. That'd be a possible solution.
Yes, the $2,500 a month he's getting, try to get 15 grand and go from there.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's just going through my mind.
Yeah, it was that kind of thing when I was talking about manipulating it or adjusting it. That was the type of thing I was talking about, is some creativity in the relationship with the employer might be able to solve this.
Okay. All righty. So let's get into non-Social Security questions to keep this ball rolling, because you know us, we're pithy and to the point and go right on. No divergence on this show. This came in from, I got his name, but no state. No state. None that I can see anyways, but it's probably a fine state that he lives in. Okay, it begins... I was reading notice. This goes back to CRDs. Do you even remember CRDs? Coronavirus related distributions.
Yeah, but I would say if it's a super detailed, complicated question, I wouldn't be comfortable answering it without looking it up. But I do remember the time in our lives that are CRDs. Yeah.
This is the last year you can pay them back.
Yeah, yeah.
So we won't get into what they all are, folks, CIDs, but they kind of came out when Corona first hit and the government was throwing money at everything and anything in an effort to appease everybody. And one of the things they said is that you can take out $100,000 from your IRA if you were impacted by coronavirus. We won't get into what impacted means, definition in the law. It's just if you were impacted, you could take out $100,000 and you had 3 years to pay it back. So you could pay the $100,000 back to your IRA over 3 years if you wanted. You didn't have to pay it back, but if you did, you can pay it back over 3 years. Okay. So he begins. He said, it would really help to know the following. Perhaps you can do it as an education show because time may be running out for people on this issue. And he is right. Time is running out. It's hard to believe that. You got 2020, 2021, and 2022. That's almost a full 3 years of dealing with coronavirus. And I don't think it's going anywhere. Okay. I was reading IRS Notice 2020-50 titled Guidance for Coronavirus-Related Distributions under the CARES Act. And I have a question. I would like to know if I can do a recontribution, and that's what payback means, listener. You're going to recontribute this money to the IRA. You're going to pay it back. So he calls it a recontribution. I was wondering if I could do a recontribution of a coronavirus-related distribution originally taken from my IRA to a Roth IRA, as long as I do not claim a reduction in taxable income for the recontribution tax year. So what is he saying in English, folks? He's wondering, could he take some of the money that he's supposed to put back into his IRA and instead put it into a Roth IRA? And if he does, he's not going to reduce his taxable income. That was part of the way of repaying it. I won't get deep into it. So he's not going to do that. He's saying, hey, I won't try to, you know, have my cake and eat it too, put money in a Roth and deduct it on my taxes. I know you can't do that. He said in the IRS notice on page 13, it says the following: recontribute any portion of the distribution to an eligible retirement plan. He's essentially saying, I believe eligible retirement plan means any type of IRA, but could it mean a Roth? I won't continue reading the rest of his question. What I simply want to let him know, and listeners who may be in the same boat, if you will, you've got some more time, you got a little bit of time left, and you have some money that needs to be repaid, if you will. There is nothing from the IRS providing guidance on this. Nothing. However, and I can only go by what the Ed Slot Group taught us on these coronavirus-related distributions. In their opinion, in the opinion of the Ed Slot Group, it is okay to pay it back to a Roth IRA, because there's nothing saying you can't.
Right.
However, they feel strongly it violates the spirit of the law. But there's nothing saying you can't. Anything you want to add on that?
No, I think that summarizes the general consensus, although I haven't heard people talking too much about it. We'll probably hear a flurry of discussion again about this as the year comes closer to a close, since this is the window's closing on this, being able to do this. I think most people are on the side of the fence you're describing, which is it should be okay. There's nothing that's preventing this. They've had some time to come out if they were worried about this and say, nope, this violates the spirit. We're not going to allow this. That, as far as I know, has not yet happened. And you paid the taxes on it. It's not like you're doing something that is letting you off the hook for taxes. It was almost like a slow motion 3-year Roth conversion via a rollover, which would normally need to be done within 60 days, and now it's taken years instead. So it's kind of effectively that, but they are right. Not that I would question them, that there's not super clarity on this from the IRS. But the fact that they've had a chance, they've seen experts trying to interpret this and opinionate about this, and had the chance to come out and say, "Oh no, that's not what we meant. You can't do that," and haven't. I think adds more weight to the "it's probably okay" camp.
Yeah, I'm totally agnostic on it, listener and listeners. Chris is right. They haven't come out, and they had a couple of years to figure this all out. They haven't come out and said you can't do it. A Roth IRA is an eligible retirement plan to receive the repayments. It's understood if you took it from a Roth to begin with, you can put it back into a Roth. But if you take it from an IRA, can you put it in a Roth? Again, there's nothing saying you can't. But there's nothing saying you can. So it's the best answer I can give you. I can't tell you to go ahead and do it, and I can't say you shouldn't do it. I'm saying you should just evaluate it. There's nothing that says you can, and there's nothing that says you can't. And as Ed always put it, Ed being Ed Slot, in his opinion, it's okay, but it violates the spirit of the law. And he doesn't know if they would go hard against that. My gut tells me they love that they love Roths in the sense they still allow them to be there. They still allow you to convert into them. They love getting their tax money now. You're not screwing them. You're not going to try to put it in a Roth and not declare it as income. So perhaps they'd be gentle on you if they change their mind on this, but we just don't have the guidance, listener, to give you any deeper, more solid answer than maybe. It's the best I can do. Okay. All right, the final question that I want to get to, only because it came, Chris, it's a recent question. It's not a deep one. It's not a one we're going to ramble on, but it had to do with the whole PTE 2020-02 show we recently did. If you don't know what that all means, go listen to it. We talk about more than just the rule. We talk about some of the explanations behind it. But someone just wrote real quick, and they wanted to know, I am a do-it-yourselfer, and I'm going to be doing Roth conversions. She called them in-kind Roth conversions. I'm gathering by that she means, Chris, at the same custodian that has her IRA, she's going to convert into a Roth IRA. So I think that's what she means by in-kind Roth conversions. Yeah, that's exactly it. I should have read on. With both originating from the same custodian, she names the custodian. I give you 47 guesses on what custodian this listener uses.
Are you asking me that question?
It was kind of said in jest. I'll give you 47 guesses. Who do you think? Who's the first custodian that pops in your mind that our listeners most likely are using?
Vanguard.
Vanguard, yes. Mm-hmm. So she's a Vanguardian. Mm-hmm. She has an IRA. She wants to convert it into a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. She's wondering, will this PTE 2020-02 have any role to play on me and require additional paperwork? No. Remember that. We said it before, and I'll say it again. All the additional paperwork has to do if the financial advisor you're working with is recommending you take your money from your IRA and put it in another IRA, or in this case, a Roth IRA. If that is their recommendation. Now, an advisor, let me clarify. We could recommend to a client, gee, we feel you should convert $20,000 this year of your IRA from a tax planning perspective. Bob crunched the numbers, and we show a client that they can convert $20,000. If we're not managing their assets, and again, personally, as a firm, we don't require people to have us manage their assets to do retirement planning with us. So if we're not managing their assets, and we just simply said from a tax planning perspective, you should do a Roth conversion, we don't have to deal with PTE either, PTE 2020-02. Why? We're not getting additional monies for making that recommendation. And Vanguard isn't making any additional monies for you calling them and saying, hey, convert. You initiated it. Where the PTE is going to come in is if the person you are working with is going to make additional monies by making that recommendation. Let's look again at my situation. If we had a client, Chris, and we said, Bob's determined you should convert $20,000, and we feel you should convert it into an IRA with my firm because of this, that, and the other thing, and that is going to result in my firm making some money off of that $20,000 that's being moved into a Roth IRA with us, then yes, we would have to abide by the PTE 2020-02 rules and walk that client through a rather lengthy series of disclosures and paperwork. So hopefully that begins to sink in. For most of you, you're never going to have to deal with this. But for a subset of you do-it-yourselfers, don't be surprised if additional paperwork comes up. All right. That was all I wanted to say on that.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me clarify one quick thing so I won't have to readdress it next week. The interpretation of the Social Security person, as well as what I essentially said by confirming it, I feel even more strongly that is correct information. Looking at an additional document from Social Security, which I was doing while I wasn't listening to every word that Jim said, there's a nice document from the Congressional Research Service, which does a lot of reports interpreting rules and describing how the rules work for a variety of things. Social Security, in this particular case, they nail it in this really clean description. It's a little more direct even than what I described, and where they describe how a grace year works. And it says, quote, a grace year generally applies during the first year of benefit entitlement. During the grace year, the retirement earnings test is applied effectively on a monthly basis. A beneficiary may receive full benefits for any month during which his or her earnings do not exceed 1/12 of the annual exempt amount, regardless of the total amount of earnings for the year. However, after becoming entitled, which is their word for actually receiving benefits, the monthly earnings test is an absolute one. If exceeding the monthly threshold, the beneficiary will receive no benefits for that month. So it's a cliff, essentially. If it's not applied in the same way the annual test is. So just wanted to put a nail in that coffin.
Okay, perfect. All right, let's see. Here we have a question that goes way back to November. This is, I think, the last November one that's, for some reason, was still lying around. It's from a California listener, gives her name, but we're going to call her Georgette. She begins with, hi there. Remember hi there? That's it just made me think of something with the hi there.
Greeting.
What? Yeah, but now I could be totally wrong on this, but didn't Freddie Boom Boom Washington used to say, hi there? Do you remember Freddie Boom Boom Washington?
From Welcome Back, Cotter?
Welcome Back, Cotter.
I don't remember him being unique in saying that, but maybe he did.
I think it was. I think that was it, because, you know, they all had their little sticks, you know. Mm-hmm. Epstein was his note. Horseshack.
So
was
is that how he would always talk to a girl or something? He'd open it.
Yeah,
there.
That was his pickup line. Hi there.
Okay.
With maybe. That smile on his face. At least I think that was Freddie Boom Boom Washington. Anyways, I have no idea why that popped into my head.
I don't either.
Short of being that it's a very late in the afternoon. But when I read hi there, yeah, I just thought of Freddie Boom Boom Washington.
Okay.
All right. Hi there. Here's a question for the show. I have a solo 401k and a SEP IRA. I also have a small Roth IRA. What is the best way for me to begin converting some of my business solo 401k and SEP IRA into a Roth? I am aware that I will need to have to pay taxes on the year of conversion. All of this money is with, you guessed it, folks, Vanguard. But will there be a cream in the coffee issue when I convert? Cream in the coffee is if you have after-tax basis in your retirement account. There will be none in the SEP IRA because you cannot put money in directly. Your employer puts money in for you. And it's always pre-tax dollars that the employer will put in. The employer is you in your SEP IRA. There's no SAR SEPs anymore, salary reduction SEPs, where you could put money in. So all money comes from the employer you. It's all pre-tax. So I can't for the life of me figure out how you might get after-tax basis into your SEP. The only way it could is a SEP is a traditional IRA, and you do not need a separate SEP IRA. This is little known fact because most advisors and custodians will open a SEP IRA. There's actually a little checkbox for it, SEP IRA. You can make a SEP contribution to a traditional IRA. You don't really need to open a separate one.
Right.
Its custodians generally don't allow it, but the IRS has no issue against it. And that came from the big guy himself. He taught us that at his classes, that you can make a SEP IRA contribution to a traditional IRA. It's no big deal. It's just that generally custodians don't allow it. If she happens to have a custodian and a SEP that was part of a traditional IRA and she had put traditional non-deductible contributions into it, theoretically, you might have an IRA that you're calling a SEP IRA that does have some after-tax. Mm-hmm. But that's like a snowball's chance in hell right now that even is the case. Chances are you have no after-tax basis.
Right.
Now, in your 401k, your solo 401k, again, I highly doubt you have after-tax contributions in it because it's a solo 401k. You right. set it up.
And you would know if you did these kinds of contributions to it and didn't deduct them. So,
And why would she do it? She would right. just allow her solo 401k to accept or offer a Roth as well.
Right.
And you would have a separate Roth solo 401k and your traditional solo 401k. So I don't see why you wouldn't have done that. So I don't see any way that she has basis. So there's not going to be a quote unquote cream in the coffee right. situation where you're going to have to worry about a pro rata rule. However, let's get rid of the word solo for a minute, listeners, and pretend she had a SEP IRA, a Roth IRA, and a regular 401k and an employer. And in that 401k, she has basis. She put some after-tax voluntary contributions in it, but she has none in her SEP IRA. If she goes and converts her SEP IRA, as we spoke about on a recent show, aggregation rules on RMDs, well, those rules kind of apply in this situation as well. Just because you have basis in a 401k after-tax voluntary contributions, which would be subject to the pro rata rule, it doesn't key over or transfer over to her SEP IRA, Chris.
Right.
As long as she has no after-tax contributions in the SEP IRA, again, there's not going to be any pro rata rule
right.
or issue. Now, she asks the best way to go about, well, to convert the solo 401k, if you're still contributing to it and it's still an active 401k, get a hold of Vanguard and say, hey, do you offer a companion solo Roth 401k that will allow in-service conversions? See if they offer that. They may not. They're the custodian. They may not want to deal with all that and say, no, we don't offer solo 401ks that can do that. But if they do, that's how you're going to have to start converting that solo 401k. If you don't work there anymore, then you can just start converting your solo 401k into your existing Roth IRA, just as you would convert and move any 401k asset into a Roth. Prior to, I think it was 2005, might be 2000, but somewhere between 2000 and 2005, they started allowing you to do that. You used to have to move the 401k to an IRA and then convert it from an IRA to a Roth. They got rid of that. They just said, that's a stupid, wasted step. You can go from 401k to Roth as a direct conversion. So I don't see any reason why you can't convert your Vanguard solo 401k into your Vanguard Roth, assuming you're not working anymore and contributing and it's not an active 401k and you want to start winding it down. Mm-hmm. Anything yep. you want to add?
No, I agree that the chances that she's got mysterious basis that would trigger the pro rata rule is extremely low, because the actions she would have taken to create that basis, she would be aware of, because it's her solo 401k. She would know if she put money in that was not deducted when she contributed it. So as long as that didn't happen, I think she's clean. But that's what you're looking for, is basis in those accounts. That's what creates it. There's no – the fact she wrote it kind of implying to me she was worried that the fact she had a SEP and a 401k created some kind of relationship there that was pro rata. No, that's not the case. It's all about the after-tax basis, if it exists in either one of those, and I doubt it does.
Yeah, I can't for the life of me see any after-tax basis in that either. This next one is going straight to you.
Whoa.
Well, because this is more of an opinion of yours mm-hmm. that he's referencing. Remember, this came in January.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe back then we had addressed this. And it's your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of disagree with it a little, folks, but I'll opine in a second.
Okay.
But it's also more of an art. Well, definitely it's not more. It is an art question, not a science question, as it applies to retirement planning. Okay.
Okay.
Hi, Jim and Chris. And then he singles me out. I don't know why. He should be singling you out. But he says, see, here we go again. They don't know how to spell your name.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Says, Jim, what is the sense of providing a retirement planning service only to folks who are going to retire within 5 years? What if the person wants to get a head start so he's not screwing up, this is his words, not mine, before then, only to come in 5 years before retirement to find out they should have been doing things way differently earlier? And that comes down to, we used to recommend to people to not do a plan with us if you were more than 10 years from retirement. But we've lowered that over the time period. And Chris, I don't know if you're five or even earlier than that now, but he kind of wants to know, hey, why? I don't know if he's calling us out for not wanting to work with people, or are we advocating people shouldn't actually plan before the fifth year from retirement? Do you have anything, thoughts you want to share with him? Again, this is more of an art than a science.
Well, I think it's totally valid to seek out financial advice at any time that you don't feel confident that you understand the full scope of your decisions, and or even if you're just looking for confirmation you're doing things right, etc. There's nothing wrong with that at any age. What I think we're talking about when this issue comes up is, should we do a full-blown detailed retirement projection for someone who's 10 years out from retirement? Well, the retirement projections we do aren't designed specifically to detect errors that you're making during early in your contribution phase or your accumulation phase. They're looking at the world that it will exist from retirement to mortality. That's where our projection focuses. So it's like we're just not looking at the years before that in great detail, because we focus on retirement planning specifically. So I think that's where our general rule and it's not a hard and fast rule. There's certain circumstances where we certainly would do a projection for someone who's out farther than 3 to 5 years. I just think the sweet spot is 3 to 5, because you still have some time to make some decisions. Maybe you haven't put in concrete your retirement date. You could work a little less, a little bit longer, etc. You can still make some of those adjustments. You're out far enough, but you're close enough where there's a good idea of what assets you're going to have. If we're 10 years out, the estimate for the assets you're going to have on hand on the first day of retirement are really suspicious. You know, they're not particularly reliable, because that's a whole decade. Where we're going to wait to see what the returns are actually going to be. Things come more into focus. They're more reliable, but yet you're still not pulling the trigger tomorrow. So you've got still some wiggle room in your decision-making for key things like your ultimate retirement date. That's why our general rule, if you will, is we like to have people do their first full-blown retirement projection at least 3. We get nervous when it's less than 3 if it's a question of, can I retire or not? Although we deal with a lot of people that have already retired and they're looking for other guidance. But if it involves making a decision of retirement date, can I do it or not, at least 3 years out is good. But when you get beyond 5 years out, then we start to have it degrades the reliability of our projected balances and what you're really going to want to be doing and what your expenses are on the first day of retirement. So it reduces the validity of the projection. That's just the thought process of how we kind of arrived at that rule.
And I agree with that part totally. I might be a little more receptive from year 10 to year 5 from retirement to consider doing an analysis, but I agree with everything Chris has said. Our job, or the job of any competent retirement planner, shouldn't be to try to get as many plans as we can done and charge people as much as we can for them. We want to make sure the information we're delivering is accurate. And if we're projecting 11, 12, 15, 18, 20 plus years from retirement, come on, folks. We can't even be sure the rules we're applying today are even going to apply in the future. It's just too far of a projection to tell someone, well, you're going to save this much and it's going to earn this much and your savings every year is going to go up by this much. So you're going to have X amount of dollars and inflation is only going to be this. There are so many variables you got to build in there. Every single variable you add to a calculation makes the results of that calculation that much less reliable. The more variables there are, the less reliable it's going to be. So we, again, feel very confident, especially as distribution planners, to be working with people who have gone through the accumulation phase. They're in the transition phase, which is generally, in our definition, our personal definition, 5 years or so from retirement is kind of the transition phase. And in that phase is where we think we can get fairly accurate numbers. When people come to me, like my nephew comes to me, hey, Jim, anything I should be considering right now? I tell him, first of all, Evan, you should look to hire advisors that specialize in working with people your age. That's not me. I don't work with 30-year-olds. But I will tell you, you should be saving as much as you can. You should max out your employer match. You should try to optimize Roths as best you can. But you should also counsel with an advisor that specializes with 30-year-olds because there's other planning aspects that Evan has to take into account that Chris and I don't work with on a regular basis, especially when it comes to raising children or funding college or private school, or if a client had a special needs child, we can still help them with the planning, but we're going to recommend a special needs expert to proof everything to make sure none of our recommendations or any estate planning assumptions being made would blow that up. So, I mean, that's our rationale for doing it. I would say there are people who, like my, again, nephew Evan, he's 30. He really doesn't need a retirement plan. And I would question any advisor who specializes in younger generation X and Y and Z. And there are advisors out there who specialize in X, Y, and Z generations. I highly doubt, Chris, they're projecting a retirement plan for Evan. They don't even know what Social Security is going to be in 35, 40 years, let alone if it's even going to be around. Instead, I'm going to hope that they're looking at these other things. How much life insurance do you need, Evan? How big is your family going to be? Where are you going to send them to school? What does your or your spouse's student loan debt look like? What type of vacations would you like to move to plan every year? How many children are you going to have? I mean, all of these types of things that Chris and I don't deal with, and retirement planning isn't one of them. You should just be saving as much as you can. I will concede if you start getting into your 40s, early 50s, you have to start looking at other aspects, and a good accumulation planner should still be looking at them for you, making sure you have good tax diversification amongst your holdings. Does it still make sense? There will become a time in Evan's life with the job he has where his salary will be high enough where Roths won't make sense anymore, and he's going to want the deduction and work on a conversion strategy. He's going to need someone to help point that out to him when that transfer period happens or the transition period happens. But you would still most likely be using an accumulation planner. So I don't know if this answers his question, but it makes sense to Chris and I, and it's why we don't actively market there. It's not our niche. It's not our specialty. A 30-year-old isn't going to hire us, and I wouldn't if I was a 60, 65-year-old retiree or pre-retiree, go hire a financial planner who specializes in Gen X, Y, or Z. They don't specialize in distribution planning and what you are going to be entering into. So there comes a time, I just spoke with someone today who's in a bind in the sense they're very happy with their accumulation planner, but they're beginning to realize that he's not going to be able to take them to this next phase of life. Mm-hmm. And they admitted, Chris, today over the phone, they like him. Mm-hmm. But they're also beginning to realize he doesn't mention this thing that you talk about. He doesn't mention that thing. He doesn't talk about this. And they're starting to realize he's not going to take them through the next phase. And I just pointed out to him. I said, you know, I don't go to the same Baba I used to go to when I was 10. Mm-hmm. Not only because he's probably dead by now, but at 10, he used to just put on these little buzz things and off. I used to look like you.
Whoa, easy.
He'd just take it all off. And off I'd go. I could go to any old Baba. It's just now, granted, I don't have much hair. It's kind of straight. It's got more than Chris. But I go to someone who at least spends a little more time and tries to design very straight, fine, no body hair as best she can. But it changed. And it, I mean, these things happen. And I just feel that you need to choose an advisor. If you're too far from retirement, maybe you should be using an accumulation planner. Mm-hmm. And just having them look at a few things from that standpoint. I hope I explained myself well, but it's just, it is our belief. You can find thousands and thousands and thousands of advisors, I'm sure, who would be more than happy to do a retirement plan for Evan or any other 30-year-old who's soon to be getting married and having a family. I just question how accurate it would be.
It's not. Let me just say that. There's just too much life to live. There's too many things that are going to happen. And you know, the value of that, I'm not sure, is worth much more than the paper, even if it's e-paper that it's put on.
And so, even when it comes to things like Chris tax diversification, which mm-hmm. we talk about, and a lot of our listeners fret over justifiably because they spent their entire careers and have amassed a million or 2 million or 3 million or 4 million or more inside these always taxable retirement accounts. We get that. And perhaps if you had a planner way back then, an accumulation planner who's doing true planning, but you're in the accumulation phase, would have pointed out to you there might have been a time where the Roth would have made sense. And then again, the Roth might not have been in existence for a lot of our listeners. It didn't come out till 98. But having a planner earlier who's looking at these things might be helping you put the tax diversification in, making these determinations. But even at 30, for me to say, and I have told Evan right now, while his income is where it is, and it's pretty darn good, let me tell you that, but it's going to be a lot higher when he's my age. And I tell him to try to max out as much as he can in the Roth while he can. And his soon-to-be spouse is also very successful. And combined, their income, I can tell you right now, will be too high for them to put money into a Roth. And they're only 28 and 30. So that's why I wanted him to try to get as much in as he could. And then maybe we'll talk about other strategies after. But for me to sit and tell Evan, you need exactly 30% and always taxable, 30 and maybe, 30 and never, I don't know Evan's future situation, and trying to guess at age 30 what his tax diversification should be is next to impossible. I won't be able to tell him because by time he is 60, I'm going to be 88 and not knowing any of what I know now. But I think in 30 years, someone can start working with him, or 25 years from now, start to get a clearer picture and see how he should be manipulating some of his accounts. Instead, I just gave him some fairly generic advice. While your income is low and before you get married, get as much into the Roth as you can, because once your income goes up and you get married, you're not going to be able to.
Right.
I looked at what was going on now for him, folks, not where he'll be in 30 years. Anyways, that was more of an art question, but mm-hmm. it was asked in January, and he seemed to want to know why we won't work with people or recommend people do a true retirement plan far away from retirement. Now, I don't know if Monte Carlo people look at it differently, if their probability statistics and projections are more or less accurate the further out or closer they are. But I know the way we approach retirement with minimum dignity floor, secure income, the way we try to get you to identify your fund number, the way we even look at asset management, where we divide the portfolio, not anymore based on risk tolerance with one big portfolio based on your 60-40, 70-30, 80-20 risk tolerance of moderate, moderately aggressive, or aggressive. We actually look at your allocation based on the risk capacity of the individual spending tasks those dollars are going to be assigned to. We call that positioning. Call it a see-through portfolio. Again, these are all different concepts, Chris, than you would in an accumulation phase. I don't talk to Evan about any of that.
Right. Yeah, and that's just, I think your haircut example was a bizarre one, but I think valid that different folks have different expertise and the services you need as you age and change. And someone that knows a little bit about everything isn't going to be as valuable as those who are particularly skilled at the specific things you need at the time. So that's where specialists come in, and specialists for, you know, elderly haircuts like you're talking about, or specialists for kid haircuts, etc., might be time to change.
I don't think I have elderly haircuts. I never heard of such a
thing. What you're describing is elderly hair. You are almost 60.
No, not there yet. Still got a long time to go.
Elder hair.
Elder hair. At least I still have mostly hair color.
True.
Unlike some people.
Yeah. I'm still not convinced it's natural, but if we get a sworn statement from your hairstylist...
If you want, I'll strip naked in front of you, and you'll see that this is natural hair.
That's not the direction we're going with this at all.
You can get a full view of my hair, and you will see. The drapes, they match the carpet.
I can't believe you said that, but yeah, okay. We have an adult audience, I guess. Well, that'll have
Chris,
to do it for the show.
Chris accuses me of using what I guess the Just for Men or whatever.
Or Grecian formula, you know, the classics. Yeah.
I don't know. He's convinced I dye my hair because I don't have much gray hair. Mm-hmm. And he not only has no hair, what few he has are gray.
Are grayish, yeah.
But I say simply, folks, it's this. I have no kids, no wife. He has 6 kids and a wife and like 14 dogs.
And it's called that's what does it.
It's called stress.
I do have stress. I don't know if it's going to change my hair, but maybe it will. Yeah, that's
You never know.
So, well, thanks for everybody listening to the Q&A show. Sorry things got a little bizarre at the end. But we do appreciate the questions. We got through 6 today. That was pretty, you know, pretty high on the count list. So keep sending them in. jim@jimhelps.com is the best email to use. Put in the subject line that's a question for the podcast. Jim, thanks for recording this today. I know it's late in the day when you get a little loopy, but that'll relieve the stress for tomorrow when I have a pretty busy schedule. So.
Perfect. Got to do all I can to keep that hair from turning gray and falling out.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Might be a little too late for me, but I appreciate the effort at this point. So you take care, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.